Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You probably have a full tummy today after yesterday's feast. I certainly did. Way too much. But I had a lot of fun doing it, and I think our Vicars of Vegetables who are with us today in the studio may have overindulged a little bit on the vegetable side, too. We'll find out as we visit with them and certainly take your questions as we talk vegetables, zero in a little bit on peppers, but really, you know what? We'll talk about any kind of vegetable you want to talk about at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. You can email us, too. If you got a haiku, you can speak it out, or you can email it at talk@wpr.org or any other question for that matter as well. And the lines are filling up. Welcome, Jim and Erwin.
Thanks, Larry.
My pleasure, Larry.
I really am. I'm pleased to have you with us already. Lori has been waiting a long time on the phone.
What did she have for Thanksgiving dinner?
Well, she's got a question for us. Oh. So let's go there. Lori, hi.
Hello there.
What's your question?
Well, my mother makes a wonderful sweet potato souffle, and every year it prompts the question, what is the difference between sweet potatoes and yams?
Ooh. All right. What's the difference? Erwin, have you got
to pounce on this, Erwin. You have to pounce on this.
It's a great question. And, you know, there's probably no other vegetable which is mislabeled and misidentified as much as the sweet potato. So, in fact, the yam is an African root vegetable from the genus Dioscorea. It is a completely different creature than the sweet potato. The sweet potato is Ipomoea batatus. It is actually a very widely cultivated. I mean,
it was domesticated by the Mayans.
Yeah,
actually.
It's an American vegetable. One of the fabulous domesticates of the great cultures of Central and South America, and it is very distinct from the yam. So, you know, it's my sense that at some time, maybe in the 1940s, 1950s, in some grocery store somewhere, this got mislabeled, right? And canned sweet potato was confused for yam. And so over the years, people have made this misidentification. But indeed, you were almost certainly eating Ipomoea batatus, the sweet potato.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you go to the grocery store and they're marked sweet potatoes in the fresh department and yams, they taste similar?
No, you know, they're both root vegetables, but the similarity ends there. Yam is a very different creature. I would say, you know, it's not anywhere near as pigmented as the sweet potato. The sweet potato really is a very separate thing, and almost certainly, unless you go to a specialty grocery store, it's very hard to find yams in our markets at all. I mean, it would be very rare to find that.
The only place it's grown,
even though
actually,
it says on the can, yam?
Yeah, those are sweet potatoes.
It's a lie.
Those are sweet potatoes.
That's not true. Yeah, that's not true. They're grown in the only place they're grown here is in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
I've seen them in Puerto Rico, but in no other area. Of course, they were introduced by the slave trade,
yeah,
right, along with okra, things like that.
An African root vegetable.
A lot of African vegetables were introduced into the south of the United States, obviously, and that's where they became popular.
So there you have it, Lori.
Thank you much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And some more callers online. But I'll tell you what, before we take Tom, you were talking about some therapy before the show.
Yeah, Larry, you know, Jim and I, you know, I think it's fair to say are very concerned about the what happens to vegetables on Thanksgiving. I mean, let's face it, there's a lot of abuse. There's overcooking. there are some unimaginativeness with respect to vegetables. And actually, we thought, you know, I don't want to tout ourselves too highly here, but we thought we could provide a therapeutic opportunity for listeners who have had to suffer through some bad vegetable experiences at Thanksgiving.
I mean, were the Brussels sprouts overcooked at all?
Yeah.
I mean, what does that lead to?
Yeah.
It's not a tenderness there.
No.
We're talking about hydrogen sulfide.
Yeah.
Right? It's going in directions that we don't feel are appropriate for vegetables.
Well, we'll talk some more about that, but I want to get Tom from Manitowoc on board here. Tom, hi to you.
Hello. I'd like to ask a question I've got conflicting answers on. I grow heirloom tomatoes, and I was wondering, could I keep the seeds from the individual ones, and will they be those individual ones when I plant them next year, or will they be a mix of whatever they pollinated with all the other?
Wouldn't tomatoes? You guess that the heirlooms are probably? I'm turning to my colleague, and I'm getting a reassuring nod.
Yeah.
So contradiction may exist out there, but it does not exist in this studio.
Oh, good.
We feel pretty confident that they are probably pretty inbred, and by that, I think you're going to be able to successfully reproduce those heirlooms. Now the question is, why?
Oh, now you've got another conflict going.
But you know, the principle that Jim is talking about here is really extends not only for tomatoes but for other heirlooms. And it's not that there's not a chance of cross-pollination there, but rather that heirlooms have often been maintained in very, very small populations, usually by gardeners like yourself who are selecting an individual plant or two to maintain over the years. And so that's why we can, while you may not get exactly the exact same genotype next year, you will get something that's likely very, very, very similar and indistinguishable.
Okay. Are there any advantages to buying them out of a catalog as opposed to saving
contribute to the economy? I think that's important.
And it's also, I think it's fair to say that a company will have, you know, probably has the resources to increase that variety on a larger scale than a backyard gardener. And what you get there then is perhaps an increase in genetic diversity. So there's no guarantee, but a seed company will probably have the resources to increase 100 plants or 500 plants instead of the one that you can do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling, Tom. Appreciate your call.
Tom didn't tell us what his favorite vegetable consumed yesterday was. I think
that's
this,
true.
Oh,
yeah,
I think that has to be an important leadoff question.
That's an issue. Yeah.
Well, we've got Paul from Duluth, Minnesota online. Paul, what was your favorite vegetable yesterday?
Well, I got to tell you, I have permanently banned the green bean casserole from my table.
Good for you. I mean, good for taking
a
stand.
And I'm not going to say any more about it. I made braised red cabbage with onion and apple.
And why was the apple was
that's a good
sweet, sweet and sour cabbage, and I served it over fresh asparagus. And it was a very beautiful presentation.
Oh my God! I'm so that is tremendous. You know, we were just talking in class as to why we had to add apple, of course, to our cabbage. It's in order to maintain the acidity, so that you maintain the pigments.
Right, because if you don't have the apple, what color doesn't your cabbage become a little blue,
like a dull blue?
Yeah,
and that's not appropriate.
This is red cabbage. Oh. So.
Yeah, that's what you want to do. Maintain the red cabbage. So you've got to add a little apple to it in order to maintain that. It brings the acidity up.
Well, I
you've done exactly the right thing.
I didn't do that chemistry. I just happened to have
no, but you. You know,
but see, it was brilliant. It was brilliant.
It was intuitive. Yeah. You just knew what to do. I'm so pleased to hear that green beans, by the way, you know, are a wonderful vegetable. Yeah. But the green bean casserole can be eliminated.
Well, you know, it's all that canned soup and
They put in that powdered cheddar cheese in that?
You know, I did a cost analysis on it. And by the time you buy the canned soup and the frozen green beans and especially the French fried onions, you can go out and buy a fresh bunch of asparagus
for the same
price.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Did you
anyway, that's not what I called about.
Yeah, what did you call about?
the previous caller was talking about seeds, and I'm a big chili planter. I've talked to you gentlemen before about it, and what I did this year was I didn't have very good chili crop this year. I don't know why, but I had to go to the supermarket and buy some Anaheims and some Poblanos.
Ooh.
I decided to try to preserve the seeds. So what I did was I rinsed them to make sure that they, you know, were clean, and then just put them on paper toweling to dry for, about a week, and then put them in little envelopes. Did I do the right thing?
Absolutely, Tom. That's exactly how I do it.
Oh, okay.
Now, on the other hand, let's talk about the failure of your crop, which is a source of concern to us, Tom.
Well, the main reason I think it failed was because I had no bees.
No, you don't need bees for peppers. Right? Unless you enjoy that humming sound, which I think does contribute to the ambiance of the garden.
It was kind of a late growing season here in Duluth.
That's why I want to talk about we are at this very moment producing seed of, because you're a roaster, and we are
I am a roaster.
Yeah, we're producing seed of the Wisconsin roaster. I was just telling Irwin before the show that
that's your signature pepper. Isn't
well,
it?
You know, a lot of people. Do you see all the press that this stem cell thing is getting?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Worf is going to make billions. You know what's number two?
The pepper.
The roasting pepper. The Wisconsin Wolf. I got this document. I was telling Irwin, I got this document from Worf. You know, embossed little gold around the edges.
This is the Alumni Research Foundation
yes.
we're talking about.
Yes,
here.
Yes. They're the they who control the patents and make the money. They have assigned licensing to the Wisconsin Woosten Peppa, which I was
behind stem cells is what you're saying.
I feel it's right behind stem cells in terms of its potential. But for Tom's immediate interest, I think the important thing is that it is an early roasting pepper, and I will have to say I gave it out at my God, it's how many dozens of fairs and field days this year, and I got a lot of thumbs up. People really like this. This is a good roaster, and it's very early. I have a lot of trouble growing the poblano.
Duluth presents a challenging environment, doesn't it? For a pepper?
Let me tell you, I have had good success with poblanos in the past. Tell me more about this roasting pepper. How hot is it?
It's got some heat. It's got some. We refer to it as happiness.
Is it a little bit hotter than a poblano or an Anaheim?
It's poblano level, you know. And so, of course, the Anaheim is mild. The bell pepper. We don't. You don't even grow those, do you?
Well, bell peppers.
Yeah, we're not going there.
I don't.
God bless you. It's right. I would say it's right at the poblano level because the poblano has to have some warmth. It has to have that, you know, that richness comes out, that heat comes out with a little, with some capsaicin.
I like the heat and the meatiness of them.
That's exactly right. And the fact that you can, the other thing that a lot of the people liked about our pepper was the fact that it was easily stuffed. You know, sometimes the poblanos will shred, you know, they're hard to stuff. These were easy
you
to.
You can fit a lot of cheese in there,
could,
is what
and
you're
you
saying.
You can fit a lot of Wisconsin. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. Where do we get the Wisconsin?
Well, the seeds are, well, you send a certified check.
Do you have to send a lawyer over?
You send a lawyer to Worf.
And they negotiate for that.
Then you will go into a process of negotiation with them. And Lord knows what will happen at that point.
Is there a secret handshake?
No, how do we really get the Wisconsin?
You send Irwin and I an email, and you say, "Golly, would like to get some seeds," and then we haven't figured out what it costs actually to produce them. I think it's going to be about $1,500, but we'll. Hold it! That's what it's going to cost to produce a quarter pound of seed.
We'll sell you
a package for Tom. We're going to give this an early Christmas bonus. I think there's a. Can we have that?
Not all, Jim.
Yeah, and can we throw in some steak knives with this?
That's right. That's what I'm saying.
Do you get
is
one of those
the Ginzu set?
And then one of those pro peel.
This is public radio.
Yeah.
I want the Ginzu set.
You want that Ginzu set, and you can. Because it's important to be able to slice your peppers
that's
with
right.
that.
That's true, too.
Anyway, no, I mean,
we're gonna have
a computer. Is there another number?
You could write a letter to Professor Jim Nienhuis, and this is my colleague here. I'm going to give you his address. Professor Jim Nienhuis, that's spelled N-I-E-N-H-U-I-S.
N-I-E-N-H-I-U-S?
H-U-I-S.
H-I-U-S.
Yep, and this is at the Department of Horticulture. At the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
And the zip code is 53706.
That's correct.
Is there a street address there?
Yes, there is.
706.
And
yeah.
The street address is 1575 Linden Drive.
Just like the tree.
Exactly. And so, that will get to Jim, and then we'll be able to help you get some seeds of the Wisconsin Woosta.
Jim will send you some seeds.
And especially if you wrap it inside a Rolex. Right. I don't think there's no question about that. Yeah.
And
thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Talking with the Vicars of Vegetables today, Irwin Goldman and Jim Neonhus from the University of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Keisha Mabra, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking vegetables today, zeroing in a little bit on peppers, but we'll take any question that you have here on the vegetable side with our guests, Jim Neonhus and Irwin Goldman from the University of Wisconsin College of Ag and Life Sciences. Really pleased to have them along. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call or email us at talk@wpr.org. Dan in White Lake is on board here. Dan, hello to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Just to show you how loyal some of your listeners are, 3 years ago you guys were on and had a fella from someplace in Wisconsin tell how he turns his peppers into biennials by digging them up at the end of the season and putting them in the basement over the winter. And that is the greatest idea since sliced bread for hot pepper. I'm up here 60 miles north of Green Bay. Our growing season is maybe 90 days. And the first year, we get maybe a dozen, 10 or 12 peppers on a habanero plant. The next year, it's three times that size, and you get four or five times as many peppers off of it. And that same thing is true with the jalapenos and the poblanos. I haven't tried the anchos.
In fact, if you put them onto sliced bread and grill it, I think it's you can obtain the best of both worlds.
But if you want to have one that makes it through the winter, you better try three or four because they're not all going to make it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm glad that. I'm so glad that works well for you. That's terrific. You should have patented that idea, Jim.
Putting them in the basement? I don't know. Well, you know, we don't have that bad of luck down here. I mean, the habanero comes in September, but it does, you know, it's slow. I'll admit that.
Mm-hmm.
But it comes in abundance.
Yeah. Right.
It really comes in heavy. And those are great for canning, and that's what we do with them. We preserve our happiness.
Right. I forgot to ask him what he had for vegetables yesterday.
Oh, yeah, we need that. Yeah.
Howard in Madison, we will turn to you next. Hi, Howard. What did you have for vegetable yesterday?
Well, unfortunately, I went to a restaurant, and they didn't have very much to choose from there.
Oh, too bad.
Well, you know, Perkins is not known for their Thanksgiving fare.
That was a minor thing. But anyway, a couple things. One, maybe the guys can finish giving the email address for the roasting pepper. But after that question here, what I want to ask about is there was some mention by these guys sometime back about grafting peppers.
Oh.
And I've got couple varieties that I started probably in August that I've got growing on a window. So I've grown peppers on a sunny windowsill and produced small chilies through the winter months. But I want to try grafting some, and I've done grafting on some other things, but I want to know about grafting peppers, and do you have to stay within the same species of pepper?
Boy, that's a great
question. Those are great questions.
You know, the funny thing is about this is that there was a paper published in an journal that might accept something I would write.
Yeah, right. It is, yeah.
And it actually said that it grafted a sweet pepper onto a hot pepper rootstock, and they said it converted the pepper, the cyan, into hot peppers. And I doubted that. And I was wondering, have you ever made that kind of a graft?
No, I've never done peppers.
Okay.
I've done some other things.
You're going to have the most. I mean, I do a lot of vegetable grafting, and it's become important in regions of the world where you have a lot of root disease.
Absolutely, yeah.
And this is very common in tomatoes, for example, now, especially in Japan, Korea, where in South America as well. There are diseases, soil-borne diseases that simply will rip the roots apart.
So could you use an eggplant rootstock? Is that what you'd recommend?
That's the only thing that they're good for.
Because forget the fruits, right? Just use the rootstock.
The eggplant has no value as a vegetable whatsoever, but its roots, it has reasonably good roots. What I did was I grafted, tomatoes, of course, onto a eggplant rootstock.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is when the incident where I had the tomatoes growing and the oak tree grew up, right? That had to be removed.
Yeah.
There was a lot of, we don't want to reveal all the sources here, but.
Was that a walnut tree?
And it had that juglans, and my tomatoes came up, they got about a foot tall, and they all wilted.
Yeah.
And this, you know, there's a lot of neighborhood concern about this because this contributed to our Italian fest. Mm-hmm. At any rate, the only way I could actually produce tomatoes there was to graft them onto eggplant rootstocks. Mm-hmm. And that's how I did it. Eggplants are resistant.
So peppers would work too on an eggplant?
I don't know. I've never tried that, but I think that would be a good way to try.
I think it's worth trying. And you had a question about whether they could be grafted across species. And, I, you know, my guess is that that's possible. Jim, have you ever done that?
Within
capsicum.
Yeah, well, I would say within capsicum probably.
Should be fine.
But you may be able to go as far as a, you know, as an eggplant.
Yeah. It's worth a try anyway. Yeah,
and it'd be fun. And the other thing is, you've got to find out, now, you can see how you can contribute to the obscure literature of the world. You can actually, what you want to do is find a hot pepper rootstock and then graft a, you know, a sweet pepper scion onto it and find out whether or not. The question is, where is capsaicin synthesized? Is it synthesized in the fruit? Is it synthesized in the root? Does it move in xylem or phloem, et cetera? Right? So it's this may be possible, but I'm a bit of a skeptic about this, and I wanted to test it. Wouldn't that be fun?
Yes.
I mean, that's what gardening is all about.
It's a great
science.
Experiment, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about physically grafting the peppers?
You just make a little V-cut with a razor. And, you know, on the scion and a corresponding cut. And then what I do is I wrapped it with plastic.
So when you say a V-cut, maybe we can be a little more graphic here in this description, right? You're essentially making a notch, like a V-shaped notch, right? Pointing up like a V would be.
Yeah.
You know, sort of think about bending over the scion a little bit, making a little V-shaped notch and a similar corresponding cut, right, on the scion?
Right.
And putting those two together. Does that sound okay?
And then wrap it up with a little plastic.
Yeah.
Because you don't want it to dehydrate. And what it'll do is it'll form sort of a callus there, and then eventually that callus will allow it to...
Cool.
And, of course, I have to keep it under very high humidity because otherwise the scion will just wilt away.
Some people will wrap something that holds moisture like peat moss, right? Around the graft. I've never done that.
It makes sense because the peat moss probably prevents bacterial infection because of its high acidity. You know what I do? I take little pieces of plastic tubing and I cut them off about a half inch long. Mm-hmm. And then I make a slit down the side of that half inch long piece.
So it's like a collar.
I just make a collar and I wrap it around and that maintains the contact. And that's how I do my grafting.
Mm-hmm.
But commercially they do, you know, there's actually a machine. I saw it in Japan. There's actually a grafting machine, and it does the same thing. It just simply makes a V-shaped sort of shape on the scion and just inserts it into a sort of a cleft right into the rootstock, and they do, you know, they do these by the hundreds, by the thousands.
And the main thing is really to have contact, xylem and phloem contact, right? As long as you've got that contact, and then you get the callus formation around it, you're good.
Yep. Yeah, you can get a very high rate of success with grafting.
Great,
so it's fun. Good, have fun with grafting.
Okay.
Fun with vegetables.
Don't forget the email address.
Oh, no.
Well, hold it. Let me get it to you. You can send it right to me, and my email is ninhus, that's ninhuis, at wisc, wisc.edu. And then it's going to be hard to – how do you send an email with a Rolex? Maybe you could send the
What about a credit card number?
Yeah, you could send the credit card number. Yeah, I just got a request for that.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just then.
Or just send your name and they'll mail it to you.
Or I'll email you a picture of a Rolex.
All right.
There you go. There you go. That's about as close as I'm going to get to that Rolex.
Thanks, Howard. Thanks a lot for calling. Jason in St. Croix Falls, it's your turn. Thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Well, we had, first time I had was a sweet potato pie yesterday.
Good for you.
Very nice.
That was pretty good. It wasn't quite as firm as a standard pumpkin pie, maybe a little bit too much liquid, but it's still good. I believe maybe this spring.
You know, you
or
could
something.
Make your own meal out of that. Isn't that like the perfect food?
It is.
It could be.
Yeah.
I thought you mentioned before that the best pumpkin pie was made out of a squash, and I was wondering what squash it was.
Oh. You know, I'm so pleased you brought this up because every year, of course, in our class, we do have a certain amount. There's a certain amount of competition.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah. The first competition, of course, is for the salsa, which you
and
may have heard
you
about.
Usually win that.
Yeah, because in previous years, there's been a lot of questioning about the counting of the votes.
Yeah.
And I want to assure everyone that this year, indeed, I even with, you know, impartial counting of the votes, I still won.
Yeah. And if Jim Packard were here right now, he'd probably say, could we answer the question, please?
Yeah.
Wouldn't he come out here and say, we should answer the question?
I forgot the question already.
I think it had something to do with what the best pumpkin pie is actually made out of, something that most people would consider a squash.
Yes. And indeed, our second competition this year is that we do make pumpkin pies in our class out of, well, this year we had only three species, but some years we have as many as five. Because pumpkins, even, you know, orange things, right, can be actually one of as many as four different species of cucurbita. Mostly pumpkin pie is in, you know, like the small sugar pumpkins.
Yeah.
This is cucurbita pepo, right? Now, what another squash that it's closely related to would be that spaghetti squash. Cucurbita pepo is not the best squash for making a pumpkin,
definitely,
for making a pumpkin pie, because it tends to be fibrous and the starch granules tend to be very large and irregular.
Yeah.
The best squash, and we proved this. We actually...
Time and time again.
We've proved it. Not only did we prove it in a culinary sense, we also... Did you notice that we actually had a microscope in the
that
lab?
That was
unusual.
That was very scientific.
Yeah, we had a microscope in the lab this time. Mm-hmm. So while we were eating, we walked past it. And in that microscope, we actually had slides of the starch granules. And what you can see with cucurbita pepo is that the starch granules are very large and irregular, whereas cucurbita machata, and the most elegant representative of that species is the butternut squash. That squash has starch granules that tend to be smaller and very uniform. Consequently, what you get is tremendous... When you get very good consistency and smoothness.
The texture of that squash
is best.
Is the best, right?
So, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. So butternut squash is what goes into the pumpkin pie.
Based on our, on the voting and observations of our students.
Time and time again.
Completely unbiased.
No competition.
Yvonne in Brown Deer, it's your turn. Hi, Yvonne.
Good morning, and you guys are making me awfully hungry.
Well, good.
What was your favorite vegetable yesterday?
Oh, well, let's not talk about yesterday.
Was it a bad experience?
It couldn't have been as bad as mine.
No, it was okay.
Oh, okay, same.
I had some failures, but I figured out what they were from. Oh. Anyhow, my basic question has to do with hybridizing that you do with vegetables down there?
Yeah.
Or in Madison?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I got a little tired. I used to work at the extension. And when we would get the seed information, people would start calling and they wanted the tomato and the carrot that had the new sugar in it, or the more sugar. And what has disturbed me is I have a niece who at 28 had a heart attack. And this is a congenital problem.
Mm-hmm.
And her dietitian has told her she can't eat carrots because they now have too much sugar in them for heart patients.
Wow.
Erwin, I turn to you in my hour of need.
Well, I want to say I'm sorry to hear about about that situation. Mm-hmm. And neither one of us, although I know we sound authoritative, but neither one of us are physicians. But I will say that carrots have been unfortunately maligned in nutrition and dietary evidence in recent years, and you may have seen the diets that focus on avoiding carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
Many of those diets also suggest you stay off of carrots. Carrots have a high glycemic index, and they certainly do have a lot of carbohydrates and a lot of sugar, but I have to put in a positive word for the carrot here. And I'm not a dietitian and I'm not a physician, but I think that the levels that we're talking about here for a vegetable like this are certainly not in any place that one would need to be cautious about. They have a high glycemic index. They do have a lot of sugar, and so that has caused people to push them away as far as the recommendation.
But how would it compare to a Big Mac? Really? I mean, would it be less than?
So I guess I agree with Jim. I think one needs to be cautious about this, and I think you'd find professional opinions that would differ from the one that your relative received.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Can I ask about corn?
Okay.
Sure.
Years ago, when I had enough land, I did grow Golden Bantam.
Oh, yeah. That's a classic variety.
Yeah. But it's very hard to find the seed.
Yes, it's an heirloom.
It must be a sugary, right?
It's an old sugary variety.
That's another one that they kept adding sugar to it.
That's right.
I would go to these farmer's markets, and I would hear people say, now, what corn has the most sugar?
That's right.
And I'm looking around, and, of course, Wisconsin is known to have people that weigh more than a size 7 does.
Well, you know, you bring up something that I find totally fascinating. The old sweet corn varieties, like Golden Bantam, were sugary. They had a gene there called sugary. And that's the original sweet corn. It's very, it's sweet, but what it has is a creamy texture. And that creaminess is characteristic of old sweet corn. The new sweet corn varieties since the 1970s have been so-called super sweets. And these have an additional gene called shrunken too. Those corns are much sweeter, much, much, much sweeter, but they're also quite watery, and they don't have the creamy texture, what we call phytoglycogen or water-soluble polysaccharide that gives the mouthfeel of the old sweet corns.
Right.
So you're exactly right. I mean, an old heirloom sweet corn variety tastes different. It is less sweet, but it is creamy compared to the newer varieties.
It's corny.
That's correct.
Yeah.
I tend to like that. I like that old type because, you know, the sweet, watery ones are wonderful, but they're not – they don't have that old-time texture and old-time flavor.
No, and, you know, I feel very sorry for these young people growing up who are running into these vegetables that are failing, as far as I can see,
yeah.
Or taste. And they don't know what it's supposed to taste like.
Well, I think you're right about that. And I, you know, in going back to the original piece of your question, I think it's hard for me to imagine that somebody could eat enough of these vegetables that they would be causing themselves a problem with sucrose or with sugar intake. Because these are really not the main part of anybody's diet. But they do represent some fabulous source of flavors and sugars. And the newer varieties in some cases are extra sweet, super sweet. They're really not. You're really missing out on those. Mm. You're really missing out on those flavors.
Yeah, you really do. I grew the half long carrot this year.
Mm-hmm. How did you like that?
Horn half long.
That's right.
Oh yeah. Well, I'm old fashioned.
Well, good
God
for
bless you.
Good for you.
Yeah. I love those old vegetables, and they were so solid. It was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And tasty.
Yep.
They are fantastic.
Yep.
They really are. It's hard to improve
on
that.
And they can withstand being roasted with a beef roast.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the best things you can do for a root vegetable is roast it.
Mm-hmm.
It really brings out a lot of its wonderful qualities.
So are you guys still adding a lot of sugar to vegetables, or are you giving that up?
No. You know, I think sweetness is something certainly that breeders pay attention to, but I would say that complex flavors... color, texture is much more important than just plain sweetness.
I focus only on the ability to roast.
Roasting, quality, yeah. So you'll find, but you will find breeders paying attention to that. Clearly, you know, we know consumers are interested in sugar, but it is one of just a sort of a palette of traits that should be taken into account. Wouldn't you agree?
I think if there was any opportunity to add any more high fructose corn syrup and actually inject it into vegetables, believe me, I think that, you know, some of the food, you know, there would be funding for that available, but I don't think that's been our focus at all.
I have another question.
Okay.
What does half long mean?
Half as long as it was before would be.
back in the 18th century, when the first orange carrots were domesticated, and this is in the Netherlands, they created three types of varieties: a very mini carrot, a half long variety, and a long variety. The long were the main crop varieties that you'd plant in the early spring, harvest in the late fall. The half-longs were carrots that were either harvested early or planted late, and they represented a carrot that didn't get to its full size, but that could fit into your cropping system. And then, of course, the mini carrots were just like you'd imagine. So the half-long represents a certain sort of carrot type that you'd put in a specific cropping system that wouldn't be a main full variety.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Yvonne. Thanks very much for calling. And Carolyn in North Prairie, your turn now. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi there. The man that mentioned asparagus, I usually don't have time to call in, but I did today. After many years of trying to grow roots that I would buy and always failed, I talked to a grower, and he said to plant the seeds. They're about the size of a radish. And as they come up the first year, it's like a little fern about 4 inches tall, and you space them out. The second year, you take those little things, and the roots are almost the size of your hand with, like, the fingers.
Yep.
And you put them about 2.5 feet apart. Don't bury them too deep, but, you know, it's not like you're putting them 6 or 8 inches down like the old roots that you buy. And 2.5 feet apart, and then you keep them weeded, and the third year you can start picking. I have two patches. One is 30 years old, and one is 25 years old, because asparagus is my favorite vegetable.
Wow.
Very nice story.
Aren't they actually dioecious?
They are dioecious.
And so, yeah. Really, but you know, I think you'd want to be a little cautious, actually, about planting the seeds. Because I think you may have some problems in terms of sex expression.
Yeah, I mean, if you have, yeah. Like, for example, the males are better producers in terms of...
Which is the irony, I suppose, because Martha... Isn't one of the varieties Martha Washington?
It is, that's right.
So to actually you know, suggest that she was a male, I don't think is appropriate. Uh-huh. But it's possible.
Well, I have both plants because I do get seeds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's a terrific story. That's wonderful.
And they freeze beautifully. So, and also, if I send for poblano pepper seeds, could I have a few?
As long as you wrap it. Now, did we mention the Rolex?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Okay.
I couldn't do that. I could send you cookies.
Hey, there you go. That's
I think we could
better.
Go for that.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Okay. Send him some cookies.
Send him some cookies.
Yeah. Okay, so if I send them to Jim, you'll share them, Jim?
Yes.
All right.
They're being produced as we speak, and I told you, Worf is just so excited. Right after the stem cell, Erwin, it's right there. It's right the Wisconsin Wosta.
That's right.
Stem Wonderful. Cells and Wostas.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Appreciate the call.
Wisconsin Wosta, the original stem cell.
Yeah, that could be it. That could be it.
Yeah.
Erwin Goldman and Jim Neon, who is our Vicars of Vegetables, with us. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with our Vicars of Vegetables, Jim Neonhus and Erwin Goldman from the College of Ag and Life Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Glad to have them with us today. You know, guys, earlier we were talking about yams and sweet potatoes. And I think, Erwin, you mentioned that slaves had brought – well, the question is, Joe from Green Bay wonders if the slaves themselves or the slave traders brought over the yams.
That I don't know.
I don't know the answer to that.
But certainly
either.
Those were introduced. I mean, those are traditional foods that were introduced into the South, and those were African, so they were introduced by that trade.
And you know, it's I don't know the answer either, but certainly that trade brought with it more than just human cargo. It brought plants, it brought all sorts of things, and it's very likely that seeds and produce was part of that.
So it probably was the traders themselves who were including them in the ship with the slaves. But who knows for sure?
That's right.
We don't know for sure.
That would be my guess. But melons, certainly African melons.
Watermelon
spread that way.
The watermelon is an African vegetable.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Joe, for that. Mike in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Real quick question. We have a shady spot that seems to be the only suitable place in our yard for a garden. It is pretty shady. It gets a little sun in the morning and a little tree shade towards the end of the day. And I was just wondering what would be a good, I don't know, fruit or vegetable for what is predominantly a shady area. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
You know, I think Jim should answer this question, but I think the first thing he's going to say is, you know, do you have a problem with getting the chainsaw out?
or do you have a neighbor with a chainsaw, which was really the solution to our shady part of the garden?
Yeah.
And I don't think that's the way to handle it.
That's really the first way to approach that problem.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or another way is Roundup.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a very effective herbicide. But if you had to plant in a shady spot, if you had to go there, what would you do?
Well, we've got to remember there's the photosynthesis thing.
There is, that is important,
and that can be an issue here. We're trying to grow vegetables in a shady spot of the garden. I don't see any reason why that source of shade cannot be eliminated.
So it's tough for anything.
You're going to have a hard time. Yeah, you'll have a very hard time.
Oh, well, I wish we had better news for you, Mike, on that. But sounds like you need to have some more sunlight. At the best, you might consider removal of some of the limbs of the trees, of the tree, maybe a couple of limbs.
Limbs of the tree. We want to focus on that.
Yeah, that's right.
Not Mike's limbs.
Right.
No, we're not. Strategically
Strategically remove a few limbs. Yeah. You might get enough sunlight then you can go with everything.
Yeah. I'd contact an arborist. That's the first thing I would do.
Or just, you'd be surprised. Neighbors come out. They have, a lot of people have these things.
They have power tools.
Yeah. And they want to use them. And you give them an opportunity and they will take it down.
So actually, maybe you're doing them a favor.
Oh, really? You're providing them an opportunity.
Yeah, I like that.
Really.
It's
exercise, a little noisy, but not bad. Not bad at all.
Well, here's another question for you. By the way, you can join in if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or at Madison at 263-1890s. Talking vegetables today with our vicars. And Deborah in Madison wants to know exactly how to overwinter peppers. That came up in discussion earlier, and we didn't really do a good job talking about how to overwinter them.
Deborah in Madison. I think the way to do this is to grow them from seed and to start them in the spring. I think going to the added effort of installing the grow lights in the basement and the heaters, et cetera, that are going to be required, I don't think that trying to maintain the plant over the winter, I don't think it really...
But if you had to do that, if it was like the personal challenge that you were going for, would you have a pepper in a container that you grew during a growing season and took it in your basement, right? Is that how you do it?
I really can't endorse it. I really can't. I think you got to go from seed.
But we have a testimonial from Duluth, Minnesota.
I know,
out there
from north of Green Bay.
From north of Green Bay. There you go. And so how would you do that?
It's going to be expensive. I mean, you're going to have grow lights. I mean, what you're saying is you're doing exactly what our earlier caller asked, and that was, how do I make it, an annual into a perennial? Take it out in the winter, which is exactly what he does. Mm-hmm. But I would say that the effort in doing that is probably not going to bear the kind of results that he might think it's giving. I think you're going to be much better off growing the plants from seed. Not only that, you're going to be able to, there are new varieties, especially how are you going to be able to grow the Wisconsin Roaster? You don't have seed of it yet. You're going to have to start seeds of my variety anyway, right, for next summer. So why not grow the rest of your peppers at the same time? I'm a seed guy.
Well, otherwise you just use the normal, you'd have grow lights, you'd have to have some heat, you'd have to have moisture. I mean, it's just simply how you do it for any other plant that you're
going to try. Same way, I imagine. You'd start out, though, with a pepper plant in a container, right?
Right.
That's the best way to do that. Bring it downstairs or the garage.
But Jim's advice is forget about it.
Start them from seed.
All right.
Grow your Worcesters.
All right. Mary Ann in Waukesha, we have you online now. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
As an experiment, I realize you may not get what you want, but I would like to know how to start peach trees from peach seeds. This is a Wisconsin peach tree that's growing in our yard.
Is that a vegetable? Isn't a vegetable thing?
I don't think they've ever claimed that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fruit guys, maybe the weather guys could answer that
maybe
question. They got a lot of good press.
Yeah,
they get
terrific. Yeah. No, we're not fruit. You know, and I want you to reconsider many vegetables. Think of it this way, Marianne, that many vegetables are fruits, but we go so far beyond that.
Okay.
I mean, this apple thing, this peach thing, you're so limited to these swollen ovaries. We have leaf petioles, Marianne. We have leaves themselves. We have stems.
And
we have
seeds and roots.
Marianne, yeah. We have hypocotyls. And think of this. Think of North Africa, Marianne. Think of someone, you know, some creative person there. And they said to themselves, what tissue can we now domesticate into a vegetable? They looked at the artichoke and said, we can make a vegetable out of giant flower bracts.
That is
true. I mean, Marianne, you know, the wonders of vegetables just go so far beyond that of fruits. Don't even consider them.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you still want to consider them.
Oh, I'm sorry, Larry.
The person to contact is Terrell Roper, R-O-P-E-R, in the Department of Horticulture at the University of Wisconsin, and he's our fruit tree specialist. And Terrell, I know, would have an answer for you on that, if you really want to go that way.
Honest to God, we have someone like that in our department?
Yeah, they do.
Okay. Didn't know that. Okay.
But you could write to Terrell Roper at the Department of Horticulture, University of Wisconsin, send him a postcard, and he will... What's the address? It's Madison 53706. The street address is?
It's 1575 Linden Drive.
1575 Linden Drive. And he'll give you an answer to that, Marianne.
And if it comes with cookies or a Rolex, I think you can send it to me no problem. I'll pass it right along to him.
Yeah. Thanks, Marianne. Vince and Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Vince.
How are you today?
Good.
I'm calling to ask, when I was young, my grandmother always raised a dried bean. We called them a horticulture bean.
How was that? Could you
say that again?
Horticulture bean?
It was a horticulture bean. They were pink and white when they were mature. You hold them.
H-O-L-D.
You hold them. You know, they were a dried bean.
Yeah.
And, you know, is there a specific name for them? We just called them horticulture beans.
Gee, it could have been. It sounds like Taylor horticultural bean, actually. Yeah, there are a lot of dry bean varieties that will do well here in Wisconsin. And I'm inspired by the fact that you remembered this name. You don't have any seed of it, do you?
No, my grandmother, I'm from Kentucky.
Okay.
And my grandmother always kept, you know, some for the next season. But she's passed away, and for some reason, nobody carried on, you know.
I would search through her boxes and belongings, and I would try to find, probably in the box, right, in the corner, there's probably some seeds, right? Don't you envision this? It's what an adventure this will be for you. You can open up that chest, right, from the 1860s, and there you're going to hear this, this little clinking noise, and it's going to be those seeds falling into that dark corner. You're going to pull them out, and you're going to recover that wonderful dry bean that you so loved. And you say it was pink and black?
Pink and white and brown, they were really mottled in color.
Ah,
okay.
I can't. Nothing comes to my mind.
Well, there's so many great bean varieties, but good for you. What about snap beans? Are you into those at all?
Well, yeah, I like any of the bean family, you know, dried beans. We eat a lot of, you know, bean soup and stuff south.
It's that fiber, right? That's that soluble fiber you're into.
Yeah.
What was your favorite vegetable yesterday in your Thanksgiving meal?
Believe it or not, lima beans.
Wow.
Oh, nice.
Oh, wow. All right. Cool.
Thank you, Vince.
Okay, thank you.
I wish we could help you out a little more there. Anne from Duluth, by the way, wants to know the nutritional differences between yams and sweet potatoes.
Yam is a very starchy root vegetable without very much more than the starch, whereas sweet potato is an incredibly rich source of beta-carotene, alpha-carotene, which your body converts into vitamin A. I suppose it's fair to say that the yam has some pretty good fiber content, but sweet potato does as well.
But doesn't sweet potato have vitamin E? It has a complex.
It has alpha tocopherol. It has vitamin E as well. So I think nutritionally, if I had to put them on a scale, you know, I'd put the sweet potato above the yam. The yam is mainly a starchy root vegetable. I mean,
in fact, if you had to survive on just one food for the rest of your life, you could do it on a sweet potato.
The sweet potato is nutritionally about as good as we have in the vegetable kingdom.
You know, it's surprising that among the three sisters that were domesticated, it was really not included. You know, in spite of the fact that it was domesticated in the Americas, isn't it surprising that it didn't have a more prominent role? It always surprises me that it was supplanted by, you know, like the ultimate source of starch, which was really cassava, yucca.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And the sweet potato did not play a prominent role.
You know, I can't help but think corned beans and squash, you know, all aerial crops, above ground fruit crops that are much easier to, you know, people to connect with. The root crops are always maligned, and I don't know why. I take that kind of personally. But I think the sweet potato has every bit as much, I agree with you, every bit as much nutritional quality as anything we have.
Well, I tell you what, we will continue our discussion with our two guests, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman, our vicars of vegetables. Jim, professor of horticulture, Erwin is as well, and also an associate dean in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at the UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking with the Vicars of Vegetables today, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman. If you'd like to join in with your questions, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Nancy's online from Ashland, so let's go to Nancy. Hi, Nancy. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Happy holidays.
To you as well.
I've got two questions, one on walnut trees and then a kind of a comment on sweet potatoes. I was wondering if they would recommend trying to grow walnut trees at all as far north. We're on Lake Superior. And what they think of using, if you would have to use, like, seed stock from a northern area, or...
Nancy, I'm just not, you know, see, you're talking to the wrong guys here.
I am.
Yeah, because, see, walnuts to us are a pest.
Uh-huh.
And they are nothing. All they
they're
do
an irritant.
Is, they're an irritant. All they do is cause anxiety with regards to the growth of vegetables, especially solanaceous vegetables.
We aren't thinking, we know not to grow them in your yard or whatever. We've got some unusable, what used to be farmland.
And why can't that be converted into vegetables? Is there an issue there?
I tell you what, on that question, you have got a good ag agent up there.
Okay.
At the University of Wisconsin in your county extension office, and I'm going to suggest you contact him. And I'm blanking on his name, unfortunately, but I've interviewed him, and I know he's a good guy, and you're going to get an answer on that one from him.
Okay, we'll contact him. Then on the sweet potatoes, in the 40s and 50s, I've on a farm, was raised on a farm up here where we grew a lot of potatoes,
right?
Regular potatoes. But my mother would tell my dad when he hauled our potatoes around this time of year, bring home some sweet potatoes. And she didn't mean yams. And the sweet potato, at least to us, the sweet potatoes look more like a russet potato, cooked up more like a regular potato. And so that's what we call sweet potatoes. Yams were dark yellow and fatter.
Well, I'm pretty sure that you could not grow a yam. You know, you can't grow a yam north of Miami, right?
Okay.
Dioscorea.
Okay.
So it wasn't that.
And they might have called it a yam, but it was a sweet potato.
It was a sweet potato.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, there must be different kinds of sweet potatoes because my family, now my brothers live in southern Alabama in Baldwin County, and they grow, when you go there, you can get, they call them sweet potatoes.
Sure.
Most of them go to West Virginia, but we'll bring like a case or so home.
Those are true sweet potatoes.
They're They're all sweet potatoes, but I suppose different varieties, just like the difference between a red and a...
There are purples, there are, you know, deep oranges, there are even some yellow types, and of course, sweet potato also has a foliage type that's very popular with gardeners all around this country, which is not really an edible.
And then, of course, there's King Kong.
There's King Kong,
There's
too.
King Kong, you know.
Okay.
Which is another Ipomoea.
You know, why do we have... You know that there's the... Isn't the state vegetable of North Carolina is the sweet potato?
That's correct.
Could you please help me understand why Wisconsin, which is the... I mean, the great state of Wisconsin. I'm not even aware that we have a state vegetable.
We do not have a state vegetable.
Oh, we don't.
I could nominate one.
Would that be the Wisconsin Wosta?
I think it could be the Wosta.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it could be the Wosta.
Well, it does come, you know, as you've pointed out before, when you make the chili relleno with that, it comes out in the Green Bay Packer colors.
It's so perfect. So, and you fill it with cheese.
Yeah.
It's a Wisconsin thing.
Yeah.
I can't imagine why people from New Mexico seem to, you know, claim this as theirs. It has nothing to do with their state.
Hopefully there are some state legislators who are listening to the show today.
But we will take suggestions, I think, on the air regarding... Yeah. Suggestions. I believe that you and I can vote on this because we're known for counting votes so equitably. We could count
for
the votes
for a state vegetable.
For a state vegetable. Because why should North Carolina be the only state with a state vegetable?
Oh, by the way, in the store the other day, I bought a couple yams, and they were like 59 cents a pound or something.
They weren't yams.
They were sweet potatoes.
Or what I call yams.
Yeah. Yes.
But anyway, in a separate... little bag, they had two in each one. They were labeled sweet potatoes, and they cost $2.19 a pound.
So you're better off to go with what they call a yam, but is really a sweet potato.
You know, this is really confusing to me. I don't know. There's a lot of anxiety there in the shopping aisles that I was unaware of.
By the way, I have to point out that Professor Francis Hole, rest his soul, led the charge for the naming of a state soil in Wisconsin, which is Antigo Silt Loam.
Wow, wonderful.
So my suggestion would be that if you really want a state vegetable, you need to follow in Professor Hole's footsteps. I'm throwing out a charge there. Because he really led the charge.
You're not suggesting
for
that
a state soil.
Fall into a hole. Is there anything like that? There's nothing like that. He wasn't implying
that. Yeah. And you know, now that I think about it, think about the number of vegetables that Wisconsin is number one in terms of production, right? We're number one in
sweet corn probably?
I don't think we're number one in sweet corn. We're certainly number one in beets.
Mm-hmm.
We're number one in cabbage for kraut. We're number one in
snap beans. We are
snap beans
processing
snap beans. How about pickle? How about
probably pretty high in pickles. I think we're number three in actually the Irish potato.
The potato. Yeah. So I mean, we really have
this is vegetable nirvana.
Yeah.
This is a wonderful place. Yeah.
So
we've got it all.
Wonderful idea.
So can't we choose among those? I would guess. You know, why can't, you know, Wisconsin, we're such a state of, it's a rugged spirit. It's a,
yes.
Why not the beet?
I like it.
All right.
Why can't it be the beet?
I like it.
Well, there you have it. Our professors, our vicars of vegetables will be going into consultation on whether or not to push for the beet as the state vegetable. And it might happen. You never know. You never know. We get the legislators involved from the big beet growing areas, and Republicans and Democrats alike would probably support it.
Do you think that Republicans and Democrats
could coalesce?
They could come together.
It's a bipartisan issue, vegetable.
Yeah, I think it could
really
work. What did Doyle have for
what did he have for Thanksgiving?
For Thanksgiving. We don't even know. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, Nancy, I thank you. Anne Marie from Pewaukee will probably tell us what she had for dinner. What did you have for dinner yesterday, Anne-Marie?
Sweet potatoes.
Sweet potatoes. Good for you.
Wow.
Well, you have a question not about sweet potatoes, I don't think.
I have a suggestion for the people who are looking for things to grow in the shade. We grow our bush beans and pole beans right under an oak tree.
Ah, good for you.
That way they don't need as much water. So they have like over 50% shade. And we also grow the lettuce in partial shade.
So we got lettuce and... pole beans.
Beans.
All right.
Thank you.
Cool. Thank you very much for calling. And so I hope our earlier caller was still listening in. By the way, on the other bean question, the bean that was sort of pinkish and white and tricolored, there is a tricolored bean itself in the Jung's catalog. But somebody else called in and said, contact Seed Savers in Decorah, Iowa, to find out more about the specific bean variety. And so one caller suggested Jung's, and I looked it up, and there is a bean that might resemble that in the Jung's catalog, but also the Seed Savers in Decorah, Iowa. Seed Savers Exchange, you can go online and find that real easy.
And those are both of those sources are going to be things that are probably well adapted to Wisconsin.
Yep. Kathleen and Madison, your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. Well, you had talked about sweet potatoes quite a bit, and yesterday we had butternut squash, which I think tastes and looks, once it's cooked, a lot like sweet potatoes. Yep. I wondered if you could compare the nutrition of the winter squashes with sweet potatoes or with each other, which are the best ones as far as vitamins.
Vitamins, okay. You're going to get a lot of vitamin A no matter how you...
Yeah.
Yeah, boy, and squash has a lot going for it nutritionally.
You know, it's almost... It's almost the same as the stem cell and the Wisconsin roaster.
Right,
in terms
a perfect combination.
It's like the one and two, right?
But it has certainly beta carotene, right, to produce vitamin A. It has a lot of fiber, right? It has
soluble and insoluble fiber, it's going to be all, you know, beneficial.
Yeah.
Are they all about the same?
Yeah.
They're all about the same.
You know, but you know the other thing that is unappreciated about squash is the fact that you can, in fact, think of this. You can use them in the summer, and you can use the flowers themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, those can be domesticated. That's a wonderful vegetable. I had those with, you know, the tempura mix this summer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was just spectacular.
Yeah.
They were so good. And, of course, the seeds themselves can be roasted, and they are very high in protein.
And oil.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
So
nutritional.
The squash is a complete food and lovely as well. Have you ever made those the squash flowers in?
No, I haven't.
Oh, put a little batter. Pick those flowers, dip them in a little batter, mm-hmm. and fry them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. One of my graduate students made this, and he wanted the romantic meal for the significant other. Mm-hmm. So I thought there can be nothing better than to make the butternut squash flowers.
The squash blossom.
Unfortunately, he forgot about the fact that those striped and spotted cucumber beetles absorb that cucurbitacin. Oh, yeah. So, and they become exceedingly bitter. And there was one of those bugs inside the flower. And of course, when she bit into it, she hit the bug.
Yeah.
And her mouth burst with that most bitter compound on earth is cucurbitacin.
Yeah.
And that's what these little creatures survive on. And so apparently the date did not go well.
Yeah.
But, that was the last I heard of it.
And he's probably the last you heard of him.
Yeah. No. He still comes to me for advice, but not on dating. Just on how to analyze his data.
Yeah.
But,
okay.
But not dating itself. Yeah.
Bill in Ashland, hi to you.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Say, I happen to acquire a bunch of onions, sweet onions, and I'm wondering what is the best way to preserve them?
You're thinking of freezing?
Yeah. Do they have to be blanched if you're going to freeze them? Or
You can actually store the bulbs for a good long time. How long? I mean, if you're talking about a period of several months, the bulbs will store.
Well, no, these ones aren't.
Are they real sweet mild onions from the South?
I don't know where they're from.
Mm-hmm.
But in
that case, you're correct. They won't store very well. Are they only under controlled atmosphere storage can you keep them around?
Dice them up and throw them in the freezer.
You can do that.
Or you could. I think you could organize the Ashland Onion Fest.
How about celery?
Celery?
Is that pretty good, or does that have to be blanched?
Well, I canned it, and I didn't blanch it prior to canning it, but it can be celery. You can can.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about. I'd try it. It's not going to hurt anything to try it.
I think it would probably work.
Yeah, give it a shot.
You know, this is an unrelated issue, but I have to ask you about this. I don't know why celery brought this to mind, but my question of the day for our listening audience, which is, you know, vast and knowledgeable, is, does anyone know of a good recipe for cardoon? I consider cardoon to be the Renaissance, the forgotten Renaissance vegetable.
It really is.
And I have queried my colleagues about how to prepare cardoon, and I am drawing a blank.
What now, if you is know, cardoon?
Cardoon is very similar to the artichoke. And you'll see cardoon grown in gardens as an ornamental plant. Looks like artichoke leaves, but it is a distinct and is an ancient, very popular in the Renaissance. If you look at, and Jim and I recently took our class to an art museum to look at Renaissance paintings, and you'll see the cardoon in there. But I agree with you. It's not something you hear people talking about.
You know, I mean, I think what happens here is that people harvest it so late, right, that it becomes basically dental floss.
Yeah.
But there must be a pre-dental floss stage of the cardoon that it must be a delicate vegetable, and I'm not aware of it.
Yeah.
But somebody might be. Thank you, Bill. Yeah.
In the meantime, try freezing some celery and see what happens.
And I would can it, Bill. Canning. I'm really into canning now.
Well, I'll tell you what, Marilyn and Washburn might know something about it, but you have a question, Marilyn. Hi.
Well, hi there. No, I was calling about the subject of a state vegetable.
Oh.
And in the Blue Book, if you're familiar with our Wisconsin
Is that
Blue
the
Book,
Republican book? Is that is this blue and red? It's not.
No.
This is a nonpartisan thing.
It is nonpartisan.
Okay.
It is
the Blue Book,
published by the
State of Wisconsin
Reference Bureau.
Yeah.
And it tells you everything you need to know about the state of Wisconsin. Okay. And it does show that corn, now get this, is the state grain. But they do not list a state vegetable. So maybe you need to educate these people.
Well, I'm suggesting the beet. I don't know.
Okay.
There's just something, you know, I mean, you've always described this in, you know, you always describe this as the huddled masses.
It's a huddled mass. It's kind of a vegetable,
But that doesn't, you know, and in the winter, we do become huddled masses here in Wisconsin, so I think the beet is appropriate.
Yeah, well, but corn is a vegetable too.
I know, and they list it as the state grain.
What?
So I'm a little disappointed. And
that's
they
because
this
it's the Blue Book.
Ear of corn. So maybe you need to work with them.
Well, that's great information.
Thanks, Marilyn.
Thank you,
Marilyn.
What did you have
for
Thanksgiving yesterday, Marilyn?
Oh dear. Well, I had. I was a guest. I didn't have to do any of the cooking.
Good.
Which is wonderful. And it can be a little tricky because I'm a vegetarian.
Ooh.
So I ate all of the side dishes.
Yeah.
I had a wonderful time.
What was the best vegetable dish that you had?
I think the wild rice. No, that's not a vegetable. Sweet potato. There were mashed sweet potatoes.
You know, I'm surprised that no one has mentioned today. You know what I'm surprised at, Marilyn? Is no one's mentioned, you know, the parsnip. Or the rutabaga.
I know.
Right? And aren't those really traditional Thanksgiving things? I had a pretty sad Thanksgiving experience.
You didn't have the overcooked Brussels sprouts.
No. You know, my mother is really into, you know, Thanksgiving dinner for us was deja vu, literally. She had apparently preserved the leftovers from last year in Tupperware. I came over expecting, my children and I were expecting our usual, you know, wonderful Thanksgiving dinner. And Grandma comes out with, she's really into this frugal thing all of a sudden. And so she brings out Tupperware from last year. Can you imagine how disappointed I was? But, you know, but some of the vegetables I really look forward to personally at Thanksgiving time are really the parsnips, you know, and those sorts of you know,
I
the wonderful things.
In a long time.
Those, I mean, but aren't they wonderful for Thanksgiving? I mean, you just a mashed rutabaga.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, that's wow. Mm-hmm. It's just not Thanksgiving without that.
How do you prepare rutabaga?
Just boil it, mash it.
That's what I do.
And, of course, sucrose is important there, a little brown sugar. Right? Or high fructose corn syrup in any form can be added.
Forget about that. Forget about that. But throw some butter on it.
Yeah, butter. You. That's important.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Mike in Hudson
It's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Thank you. I have a question. If the gentleman have had a good experience with a refractometer in measuring a plant's general
carry one in my back pocket constantly. Mm-hmm. Right?
Refractometer?
Yes.
And what does it do?
Measures the sucrose or the energy in the plant.
Okay.
It actually measures the dissolved solids, right? So you express a bit of juice from a fruit or a vegetable, and what you're measuring is the light that's passing through or not passing through the device, and it's mostly the dissolved solids. The dissolved solids in most cases are primarily sugars, right? Primarily sugars, but, you know, say 80 to 95% sugars.
Yeah, you're going to get some pigments
you'll
in
get
there
some,
as well.
You'll get some pigments, and it's a very good device to quantify when a melon is ripe,
right?
For example. Or and maybe that's where you were going with your comment.
Ripeness as well as overall health as we're going along. You can also, I believe, check the leaf. I know in sweet corn and some others, in field corn, just to see if that leaf is coming along. And if we can sometimes juice the plant up a little bit more if we're after a certain date. We do it in grapes all the time.
Yeah. The fruit people do. In California, everybody has a refractometer in their back pocket because they do grow a lot of... and you're trying to find the optimal sugar content, right?
Yeah, so and the general health.
And melons, people who grow melons, especially in watermelons, because these are difficult. Everyone loves to grow melons and watermelons, but when do you harvest them is the question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to figure it out. Some of the varieties are slip. Some of them have non-slip. But the bottom line is that they're only going to get as much sugar as they get from photosynthesis. They're not going to convert. They don't store starch, so they're not going to convert starch into sugars. What you want to do is maximize the amount of sugar. So people use the refractometer to monitor the sugar level so that they can maximize flavor, and I'm sure growers use it so they can please their consumers.
Yeah.
We would also go back to general soil health, and have you had any luck with measuring the soluble minerals in the soil, meaning there's a certain test. Oops, I didn't have that sheet right here.
Oh, this is like cation exchange. No, I don't think I use a refractometer for that.
This is the end result of having good, healthy soil. Help to grab it here. And if you have any other comments.
I'm not familiar with its use in that area.
Not familiar with that one, Mike. Thank you for calling. I want to get Larry on from McHenry, Illinois. Larry,
McLarry.
Quick comment?
Well, I wanted to give Rutabaga a plug. But
Larry, God bless you. And, you know, you're from my part of the country, McHenry. I'm from Woodstock.
Well, I've had Rutabaga for 60 years, and it's with a little bacon in it.
Isn't it, you know, we call it in class, we call it the Arnold Schwarzenegger of vegetables. You know, isn't the rutabaga like, isn't it just a little oversized? Or do you harvest them at a young, tender size?
No, I'm getting big.
Yeah, I'm getting big. And if you want rutabagas, go to Cumberland, Wisconsin, if I'm not mistaken, where we have a rutabaga festival.
No kidding.
And a rutabaga, in the past, there was a rutabaga queen. And and rutabaga are grown in that area, and there's a rutabaga festival go online to Cumberland, Wisconsin, and you'll probably find out when that is. They relish, so as to speak, the rutabaga.
Does Larry grow them, though? Do you grow your own, Larry?
I want to mention about the carrots.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what. Tell us carrots are good for us because we've got to go.
Well, they're good for you, but if you have diabetes, which is a precursor to heart disease, which I have, if I eat carrots, literally, my blood sugar goes
shooting
130,
up.
140, and I don't know why that is.
Well, I tell you what, it's good to know that, and I thank you for calling. And Jim and Irwin, I thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Jim Nienhuis and Irwin Goldman from the Department of Horticulture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our guests. And we'll talk grapes tomorrow with winemaker Philippe Cocard. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Net.